Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Lauren Weinstein as we talk about high technology right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We'll take your calls with Lauren Weinstein as we talk about high technology. Lauren, how did you get into this in the first place?
Interesting question. When I was a kid, I was always playing around with typical mechanical pulleys and gears, and then I graduated to bells and buzzers and light bulbs. One of my early projects was a telephone answering machine built out of an Erector set. So I think at that point the path was starting to become clearer. It became possible to start building your own microcomputers. This is like the old MSI 8080. That's the one with the red and blue panel switches that the kid used in war games, supposedly. But it got very famous from that movie. So those were kits. So you start building your own computers. And at that point, I got to UCLA and got involved in the very early ARPANET work. And I just continued from there to here.
Straight line, almost.
Yeah.
At this point, are you, as you look at the technology that's out there now being used by all of us, are you amazed at its rapid growth?
Yeah, I would not have anticipated how quickly it was commoditized, for one thing. When you look back at how expensive the early equipment was in the dollars of the time, it's absolutely mind-boggling how expensive it was just to get a terminal like we were talking about, or a small amount of computer memory. I mean, it's insane by today's standards. And you were talking about when the dollar had a lot more value too. Also, I would not have anticipated that the internet, or when we started it was the ARPANET, would have been the force it has become. Because back then it appeared to be it was a government-controlled project. It didn't look likely that it would become commercialized or available to people at large. And it took a whole series of somewhat unlikely events and some people who took some real financial risks and other kinds of risks to make that happen for it to become basically the underpinning of our communications now. And even now, I think back on this, I say, were there clues, were there things I could have looked at back, say, in 1972 and said, boy, this is going to become the world's communication system? And no, I just didn't see it happening. I thought that the phone companies would take control of it and do it a different way. Of course, now they're trying to do that. I mean, all these years later, the phone companies and the cable companies are sort of trying to make up for lost time in terms of controlling these things. But back then, it was an experiment. Just making the bits flow from place to place was an effort and an accomplishment. And to see what it has become now, the underpinning of watching television and movies and telephones and hospital communications, all these things, it's both surprising and gratifying. And I'm really glad I've been able to see the whole thing from basically the very start to now.
How about the next 10 years? What do you think?
Oh boy! Well, if we can get past the net neutrality, hump here and deal with that properly, then there's really tremendous potential. I think people are going to be seeing the availability of much higher speed broadband than would have been anticipated some time back. We're starting to hear now about not just 100 megabits, but 300 megabits, and then there are some gigabit systems. And it's hard to anticipate what kinds of applications will come from that. I mean, it's easy to say, well, I don't necessarily need that. I could watch a movie on a lower speed circuit. But once you have that kind of capability for those kinds of speeds, if the pricing is reasonable and if we don't get, if we can get out from under this kind of monopoly situation, the kinds of applications we're going to be seeing coming down the line are things that we can't even really imagine now. And the kinds of companies that are going to be getting involved in this are going to be companies that right now don't exist but could become household names, by the time a decade has gone by. So there's tremendous potential if we don't mess it up.
Okay, we go to Joe in Springfield, Oregon to get things going. Joe, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Joseph.
Hey, Lauren, I've become concerned about the effect that microwaves are having on our environment. I live here on the beautiful Lower Mackenzie River here in Oregon, outside of Springfield, and I have lived here for over six decades, and every spring, the return of the swallows was just like Capistrano. And in the spring of 2010, they all showed up as usual and began fighting over the nesting places, and then suddenly they all left at once, en masse. And that was coincident with the microwave towers across the river changing from 3 to 4G. And I began looking into this, and I find that this has been noticed by others. For instance, the Electromagnetic Radiation Research Foundation of South Africa, one of their researchers noted that globally there was a coincidence of massive bird die-offs and the changing to 4G. And I have began, I'm a professional geologist, and I've spent a lot of time in the field, and I have been watching the disappearance of birds in the fields and on the reservoirs and on the rivers, and even on the beaches. I went to a huge, long beach south of Winchester Bay. You could see for a mile in each direction. There was not another single living soul on that beach, not a single bird, not a seagull, not a sand snipe. I went on up the coast, and I eventually came to Cedar Head, where there's a thing protected by great big sea cliffs and a creek coming in there. And there was a normal bird population there, but there wasn't any cell phone coverage. So I've been looking at the coincidence of absence of birds and cell phone towers. And then I got involved with a group that is concerned about smart meters being put on their homes.
Oh, sure. There's a lot of people concerned about that.
Yeah, and I'm going down to the Public Utility Board meetings, and people are coming in there who say, oh, gosh, when the landlord went and put the smart meter bank on the apartment building, I started to get sick, and I got sicker and sicker and got to the point where I couldn't even stand to be in the same room with a cell phone or a computer. I think that we are far under investigating the actual effects that these microwaves are having on our environment.
Want to react to that, Lauren?
Yeah, I don't spend most of my time doing RF stuff, but I certainly do some. I track this area, you know, the best I can. In the literature that I read, you know, which is, you know, the hardcore, you know, engineering stuff, I can't find any correlations. And in fact, you know, talking about going from 3G to 4G, there really wasn't a major change in frequency or power or anything between 3G and 4G. When it went from 2G to 3G, there were some significant differences in the transmission formats and things like that. You know, more gross changes. Now, you know, anecdotally, I mean, one of the big problems that the cellular companies have is trying to get birds and bird nests out of those antennas, because a lot of birds like to be in them because they're nice high places and they provide, you know, places to put nests. And I see microwave antennas all over the place that are just covered with birds' nests. You know, the thing that has to be remembered when you look at this kind of thing is the old, you know, the old science saying, correlation does not mean causation, right? Just because you can say that A has happened and then B has happened does not mean that A caused B, because there's so many other factors that are involved. Generally speaking, just in terms of medical knowledge at this point, the power levels that are involved in these things, even a cell phone with the antenna next to your head, are so comparatively low that they can't even find the, you know, any biological impact from it other than heat, and the heat levels are very low. It's the same thing with smart meters. The amount of power that those things put out is basically, you know, it's like a cell phone that's running for very, very short periods of time. It's basically the same technology.
Is there an internet kill switch now? Does government have that?
No, there's no way to do it. There's no way to. The beauty of the internet at this point still is that it is independent networks that are operated by, you know, the cable companies and the phone companies and many thousands of little private networks that are all interconnected, thousands, millions of private networks. And there's just nowhere you can go to actually turn it off. Now, there's things you could do to make things very difficult. You know, if you could go to the root servers that are involved in domain name translations, right, which is how you translate .com and .org and .whatever to addresses. Those are kind of those are servers that are in, that are key to that kind of addressing. The thing is, those are scattered around the world, specifically to make it difficult for failures of one, either purposeful or accidental, or just a breakdown, from affecting the whole world. So it's very, very difficult. I mean, there's people that have looked at this in a lot of detail. It's hard to see how you could effectively turn the internet off. You could certainly do this, you could certainly disrupt it, but the impact of killing the internet, of playing around with that stuff, would probably affect government, critical government services, more than anything else, because the government is now so reliant on these systems and these services, and there's no good way that they could say, well, let's turn off this part and leave this part on. I mean, you don't say never on this, but just based on the technology as I understand it at this point, and the kind of ad hoc way that so much of it has been put together, that's kind of a saving grace in this case. It's, there's no single point you could go to and say, let's just push the big red button. That's how I see it right now.
What's the central clearing point for the internet? I'm trying to picture, Lorne, how the thing works.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to myself, is there one building that just feeds everything out to all the other little tributaries?
The short answer is no. There's no one building. Now, to the extent that our communications infrastructure is centralized, that is, a lot of power is in the hands of Verizon and AT&T and Comcast, just like we were saying, they're making independent decisions about how they bundle their communications, you know, where their cables go, where their facilities are, where their transit centers are, all these kinds of things. So, you know, there are concentration points. Around the country, there are places where all the networks, where the networks meet. There's a concept in the internet that's called peering, and it actually gets back into net neutrality issues too. But it has to do with how one network talks to another and how much data flows from one to another. And there are buildings in major cities where all these networks kind of come together, and there are rooms where, that are basically just rooms full of jumper cables going from one network to another, literally, to tie all these networks together. So there are, you know, there are individual buildings that are very important to the internet, and if those buildings disappeared from the face of the earth, or, you know, caught on fire or something,
right,
there would certainly be major disruptions, but it wouldn't be like the internet would be shut down. Of more concern to me is just the way the addressing system works in terms of, you know, people are so reliant on using names as opposed to numbers that, you know, you use .com, but that's translating to a set of numbers. Even if you couldn't do the name translations, which are dependent on more centralized facilities, you could still do things by numbers, but nothing is really set up most of the time to do that in consumer systems. That is a concern. But even that, like I said, that's been distributed around in such a way to make it very difficult for it to be taken down at once.
Let's go to Randall in Bunker, Missouri. First-time caller for Randall. Go ahead, sir.
All right. Thanks, George.
Sure.
Huge fan of yours.
Okay.
I was wondering his thoughts about the group called Anonymous.
Good point. Good question. Anonymous. I would say, who are they? But they're anonymous.
They're anonymous. That's right. If we knew who they were, they wouldn't be anonymous. Yeah. Well, you know, it's not quite clear, you know, to outsiders what, you know, what their agenda always is. You know, they're obviously trying to call attention to different things. You know, if you view them as a hacker group, in some cases, that's probably accurate. If you view them as more of a loose-knit political confederation, in some cases, that may be accurate also. I personally, you know, tend to think that it's more of the loose-knit kind of variety. I think it's a lot of people who kind of have a similar sense of interest in different areas, and they want to make a point, you know, using their technological capability to do it. I don't think that it is a very organized, you know, in the formal sense, kind of operation. And, you know, I think it may actually kind of form on a sort of an ad hoc basis itself, you know, for different issues and different concerns. But, they, you know, there's so many different kinds of things that they that they act on, covering such a wide range, that it just kind of suggests that it's people that with common interests who feel that they want to, you know, use the technology to make a point in different cases. And you may agree or disagree with the points they're trying to make, but I think that's the likely structure.
Okay, next up we have Carol in Columbus, Ohio. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi.
Hi there.
I don't have a computer. I don't have cable. I don't have a cell phone. I am not going to pay for TV. If they make me do that, they can take the TV. I have a landline, and that's all I'm ever going to get. And if they try to force me into getting one of those other things, they can have the phone. I am not going to pay these people who want money, who are going to manipulate me, to take money out of my pocket for this junk.
But we are going to chip you, Carol.
What's that?
We're going to put a chip in your hand.
I don't need this stuff. I'm 78 years old. I don't need it.
Have you ever used a computer?
At work.
But you don't have any desire to use it at home?
None at all.
Huh. I couldn't function without it, Lauren. Tell me your thoughts on Carol.
Well, I think it's you know, people that feel strongly about that are going to be in a very difficult position, because so much of basic day-to-day things that we have to do, interactions with government, interactions with stores, paying things, basic research functions, things like that, are moving, obviously, or have really moved online and to the internet, to the extent that there's a lot of things you used to be able to, you know, go into an office and do somewhere that it just isn't even practical to do anymore, because the assumption is you're going to use computers to do it. So while I can understand where she's coming from. I mean there's certainly a sense, if you haven't grown up with this and lived with it, there's going to be a way of looking at it that says it's just too much, and I don't want to deal with it. And if you can successfully do that and accomplish the things you want to accomplish in your life, more power to you, definitely. But I couldn't do that for the sorts of things that that I feel I need to do, and I think that's just going to be a stance that's going to be in terms of not, you know, at least getting involved with the technology to some point. I think it's just not going to be practical in the long run. But, that's certainly going to be an individual choice, always.
I mean, there are some things I could function without, Lauren, and I don't use a computer as extensive as, let's say, my producer Tom does.
Right.
But I would still need it. I mean, I need it every day to do what I do, communications with my staff, sending messages back and forth for what I need, research. I got to have it for that.
Yeah, and in fact, it's, and there have been fundamental changes that have occurred. So, for example, there's, people are calling themselves, making voice phone calls a lot less than they used to. That's been driven by a number of factors, including spam, and solicitation calls and things that have just driven people crazy. So it is not at all uncommon now to use the internet to send someone an email to arrange a voice call, right?
Okay, my friend, stay with us, Lauren. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back, talk more, take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, final segment with Lauren Weinstein as we talk about high technology. We're going to take your calls in just a second. Lauren, as we approach, 2015, and things just keep rolling along in election year, do you think we'll ever get computerized election tabulating where people at home will simply touch a button, they'd be registered, and they just vote that way?
I sure hope not.
I agree.
And in fact, you will find that the vast majority of computer scientists who've looked at this area agree with me, and apparently with you, on this. It's a terrible idea. It's a disastrous idea. It turns into not hacking game networks. It turns into hacking the vote. And the reason is that the kinds of computers that we have in our homes right now are fundamentally not secure. Even though we use them for shopping and things like that, those are all situations where if something goes wrong, we're going to know about it. You know, in other words, if someone made an extra purchase on your credit card, eventually you're going to know, right? You're going to see it on your bill. Unfortunately, we know how easily these systems can be contaminated by viruses and by worms. Happens all the time. That's how a lot of these password stealing things occur, and much worse. Bank account information gets stolen from people's computers because of viruses that have gotten onto them through all kinds of different means. Imagine if you had viruses that could alter your vote.
Yeah.
Imagine a network that was set up to send out viruses to millions of computers over a period of time and just lay in wait for an election and change the vote. And the thing about that is you wouldn't have any way to know, because on your computer it would look correct, and at the other end there'd be no way to prove what your vote had been intended to be in the first place. It's terrible. It's so bad even with electronic voting, touchscreen voting, where you actually go somewhere and you vote on a touchscreen system. Those have turned out to be so incredibly flawed in their software and easily subverted. That's why so many municipalities are going back to like Scantron forms, where you fill in the little bubbles and things like that, scanning forms, because they're much more secure and you have a record of the vote. You can go back and you can look at those sheets again. And it's attractive. Think about internet voting. Yeah, you're just in your robe. You don't have to go anywhere. You just go up to the computer and you vote. Disastrous. And even theoretically, there's no clear way how we can even get started toward being able to make it secure and anonymous and provable afterwards. So I hope, that it doesn't come to pass. I know it's attractive. I know that in some areas they're experimenting with it for local elections and things like that, and for overseas voters and things like that. But from my standpoint, and again from the standpoint of most scientists that have looked at this and computer specialists that have looked at this, it's something that we're just not going to be able to do in an appropriately secure way. And one thing you don't want to screw around with is elections.
No. You really don't. Off to some final calls. Teresa is in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Teresa, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one has to do with time. And I have discovered that when I get on the computer, time disappears. I can be on it for 8 hours and not know it. And the first time that happened years ago, I had alarm bells go off. So I don't go on the computer very much anymore. So what is the connection between computers and our perception of time? That's number one. Number two is Prime Minister Netanyahu was at an airport, and he had all of these people, a crowd of people around him, and they all had their cell phones up in the air taking pictures of him. And he stopped, and he turned around, and he looked at them, and he said, "You're all slaves." And to me, that meant they were all slaves to their cell phones or technology or computers. And do you think we are all slaves to technology now? And I will listen off the line to your answers. Thank you.
Let's see. The first question was about basically
computers and time.
Computers and time. Yeah. Well, I think what you're really looking at there is the fact that if you get absorbed in this stuff, it does seem that way. I mean, you could be sitting there and you can be browsing on the web, and you turn around and 2 hours have gone by and 3 hours have gone by, and for some people this can be a really serious issue, because there are folks who get so involved that it becomes their entire life, and they neglect other things. And it's especially a question when it comes to kids, right? Because you really don't want kids spending all their time and being so absorbed in computers. You obviously want them to learn. You want them to be skilled at this. It's going to be very important to their futures. But there need to be some kind of limits so that they're doing other things as well. There are some people for whom computer use can be classified as an addiction. Just like other addictions where time kind of truncates for people that are when they're involved with the drug or whatever, that could happen with computers too. So it means we do have to be careful. Let's see. The other question was
Had to do with Netanyahu telling everybody that they were slaves.
Yeah, you know, it is funny because, you know, I've seen comparisons of certain events that occurred, say, 20 years ago. I forget what it was, I guess in England. And then 20 years later, the difference 20 years ago was everyone was sitting there in the audience watching the event. And then 20 years later, today, everybody in the audience is standing there sitting there holding up their cell phones to take pictures of the event. You kind of wonder if that's really a great experience as opposed to just watching it rather than playing around with your cell phone. But the underlying question there was, are we slaves to our technologies? We certainly can be. I mean, but that's our choice, right? The machines are not going to enslave us unless we choose to become enslaved one way or another. And I don't mean that in the way of killer robots or the Matrix or anything like that, but I mean in terms of how we choose to spend our time and how we choose to run our lives. I've probably spent more time on computers, having started so far back, than most people, but I have made a concerted effort to try to keep some kind of balance, maybe not as successful as I would have liked. But it is important. It is important not to be so entranced by the technology that it becomes, your entire life, because then one way or another you are sort of becoming enslaved. If in the far future the machines become so intelligent that they can actually enslave us in a serious science fiction kind of way, and if we allow that to happen, well, I guess that'll be our own fault.
Next up, it's Russ's turn in Portland, Oregon. Russ, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi there, Russell.
I'm also concerned about Big Brother, that these cell phones can track where we are all the time, and there's companies out there building dossiers on everybody, how they're going to vote, what they're going to buy, and, that kind of information is pretty powerful. The government could take up that information and use it against us.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And that is one of the big issues, Lauren.
Yeah, well, it's certainly an issue in terms of what information we wish to provide. The problem you have here, for example, when you're talking about cell phones and locations, is that cell phones can't really operate without providing our locations one way or another. There's issues of how precise, depending on whether you've got GPS turned on or not. But, you're talking to radio towers, and it's possible to always triangulate. And the government increasingly wants access to that information, and there's a lot of questions about when they should have access to that kind of information and whether they should need a warrant, for example, because traditionally, of late, they have... government at all levels has basically argued, well, you shouldn't have to have a warrant for that, and most privacy interested organizations, including my persons like myself, think you should have to have a warrant for that kind of information. In terms of commercial use of data and of that sort, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that the reputable companies that are working in this area usually have ways for people to opt out of these things and specify what they want, what information they want to give and what information they don't want to give. And most people don't bother to use it. They just don't choose to be selective about that. And I don't know what the answer is to that. No matter how you try to explain the options that are available, a lot of people just won't avail themselves of it. Now it can be argued, that if people were willing to pay a tremendous amount more per year, for example, for internet access, you could do some things now on a pay basis that are done on an ad-supported basis now. But when push comes to shove, you find out that people really don't want to pay, and they would prefer to see the advertising. So I really think it's like so many of these other issues. It's a matter of personal choice. But most of all, it's a matter of becoming informed of what options are available to you, and not just saying, well, I'm not going to pay attention, and then I'm going to complain about it. I certainly try to educate people about this sort of thing whenever I can, and often people say, gee, I had no idea. So, you've got to be aware, and you have to purposely, consciously educate yourself about this and then make those choices and choose those options that you think are best for you.
Okay, let's go next to Kathy in Louisiana. Hello, Kathy, go ahead.
Okay, question is, can the government or the UN or some body like that totally block information coming in that we can use on the Internet? Can they just say, well, this particular country is not going to get this particular type of information? I heard something on the radio a while back, and it just said that next year something is expiring, that this can be changed, and our right to control what information comes into the United States on the Internet is going to be given up to the UN to make them to make decisions or something like that. It sounds awfully wild to me, but I don't know. Can you just block a whole country off and say they can't get the Internet at all?
What you're probably referring to has to do with, and we've talked about this, George, the UN and the ITU.
Yeah.
Situation, which kind of revolves around the whole issue of internet governance in general, and there's a lot of concern that I'm in the camp that says we really don't want the UN in control of any of this. I mean, I don't want the ITU involved. I don't want the UN involved. And in fact, you can't. The UN isn't in a position to say, well, this country is cut off from the internet. But what they can do is kind of provide cover for governments in some countries who want to be very restrictive of the internet in their countries. So there are countries, and we know who they are, who are very interested in censoring the internet for their citizens and for their population. And to the extent that censorship provisions and control provisions like that are endorsed either explicitly or implicitly by an organization like the UN or the ITU, that basically gives leaders who want to be those censoring agents the cover to do it. And I think that's very, very bad. And while there's usually ways, and there's almost always ways for people in the know to get around internet censorship. So, for example, China has a massive censorship system run by the Chinese government. Russia has tremendous amount of censorship on the internet. People in the know can find ways around it, but it's complicated. It can be complicated. It can be a hassle. Sometimes you're taking a risk in doing it, because if you're discovered, you can get arrested and thrown into a dungeon somewhere. So this is a matter of real concern, and so this whole issue of internet governance is a major one. It's a continuing one, and there are countries in the world that are very interested in censoring, and they would really like the UN to become the official kind of leader of internet governance, and the U.S. is very much, officially, the U.S. is very much against that, and I agree that having the UN and the ITU in a role like that would be very, very bad.
Yeah, it sure would. Let's take a few more calls. We don't have much time left. Wes, truck driving in Michigan. Wes, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George? Thank you.
Good,
for
Wes.
Taking my call. I just kind of want to expand on a little bit of what one of your former callers, a couple callers ago, said about too much people just using too much technology. I actually kind of took a technology vacation. Other than just necessary internet usage, I pretty much cut out my internet, Facebook and all that, for a month, and I gotta tell you, it was quite liberating, really, and refreshing. Also, you don't really see, now summertime, I am a truck driver, I see cars, people going on vacation and all that. You never see anybody looking out the windows anymore. You see a whole carload full of kids, and everybody's on their cell phone looking down. Nobody even knows where they're even at, what's going on around them. And which kind of brings me to my question. Please tell me that there is something in the works that will stop people from texting and driving. I see so much of it, and it's It's real bad, really bad. It's getting worse still.
Yeah, this is an important question, and there's all kinds of ideas about that, and there are apps that try to do it, and there have been attempts at laws that would legislate technological ways to do it. It's a difficult problem because, first off, you basically to do it right, you need something built into all the phones that would cooperate with this. And that's tricky to do right now. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's tricky. But the other thing is that normally it's considered unreasonable to put restrictions on other than the driver, because you can have other people in a car who have completely legitimate reasons and perhaps important reasons to still be making calls and to be doing texting and things like that. And to come up with a way to say that the driver can't do that, or perhaps, you know, only in emergencies could they do it, they could call 911 or do emergency things, and not also affect the other people in a car, in a you know, confined space like that, is technologically very, very difficult to do. But there are, this is an area of real concern, because drivers doing that are a real risk, obviously. And I don't know where that's going to go. But it's certainly an area that a lot of people are looking at with great intensity.
Oh, sure is. Lauren, about a minute left. Let's see, John. Let's squeeze you in here in New York. Go ahead, John.
Hey, how you doing, guys? I don't even have the time to begin to scratch the surface. But all I can say is that we should do a program sometime, George, about people talking about the alternatives. Because to put it very short and figuratively, I see people using crutches so much they've forgotten that they have legs. And second of all, if you ever saw that sci-fi series, Star Trek II, where the enemy was the Borg, and you understood the dynamics of how the Borg worked and the hive mind, do you know what I'm talking about, both
yep.
you guys?
Resistance is futile.
Yeah, but the Queen controlled all the drones. When I saw this computer and cell phone come in, because I've been doing this for over 50 years, I started with computer science in the old days when a whole room of an office building had the looked like reel to reel things, and
yep.
you did the punch cards. Remember those?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I was in it in its infancy, and it was interesting back then. I took computer science in college, but then when it progressed and the technology started stepping up, and a friend of mine who at the time worked for Hewlett Packard in research and development told me about the government mandates that they have back doors built into computers and stuff. I looked at it. I said, "Gee, this is a way to observe and control."
Well, that's absolutely right, Lauren. Thank you for being on the program. We're out of time. Great 2 hours. Up next, much more on Coast to Coast AM.